The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meets Tuesday to discuss amendments to the development code regarding accessory buildings. Joining us by phone to explain what the commission will be considering is Summit County Planner Ray Milliner. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Looking forward to know more about what will be discussed during the Planning Commission's work session tomorrow. So maybe you can start off by telling us just a definition for us. What exactly is an accessory building? Is that anything a resident can build on their property?
Yeah, an accessory building is a building that is subordinate to the principal use. So primarily when you think of an accessory building, it's like a garage or a barn or, you know, a tough shed or something like that.
Okay, so what's the current code for accessory buildings since we'll be looking at some changes?
Okay. Currently in the Snyderville Basin, if it's less than 2,000 square feet, it's an allowed use, which means you can just build one as long as you get a building permit. And if it's between 2,000 and 10,000 square feet, it's a low impact permit, which is an administrative approval by the staff, the planning staff. And then above 10,000 square feet, it's a conditional use, which means it would be reviewed and approved by the Planning Commission.
That seems quite large to me. Can you kind of give us an example of what kind of structure that could be at that size?
At 10,000?
Yeah.
Yeah, 10,000 square foot building, I'm trying to think. It's pretty big. It's, you know, gosh, I don't have a good example for you of size that everybody would know. The Osgathorpe barn, I'm guessing, is about 20,000 square feet, if that helps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, why are these proposed code changes coming at this time? And maybe you can kind of explain what the recommended changes are.
So the reason that the changes have come up at this time is that over the past few years, we've had a bunch of accessory buildings come in for conditional uses, and the public has come out and been very vocal about not wanting to have these large buildings in their neighborhood. There's been some discussion about the size, the aesthetics of the building, you know, the visual impacts of the building in the neighborhood. And the Planning Commission has, along with the County Council, have directed us to look at this and to come up with some regulations to maybe restrict the size and the number of buildings and so forth on the lot.
Are there any particular neighborhoods where this is really an issue?
Yeah, the two biggest neighborhoods that we've had problems with, or, well, not problems with, but there's been the discussion, is the Old Ranch Road neighborhood and Silver Creek. Highland Estates has also had some discussions, but it's mostly the places that have larger ranch-style lots.
Can you kind of further explain what kind of impact these accessory buildings might have on neighbors? Is it just kind of like an aesthetic thing or what?
Well, the comments that we've gotten are aesthetics. You know, it's like you build a big 20,000 square foot building right next to someone's property line, and it's got a significant aesthetic impact on the neighbor, you know, blocking the view and stuff like that. Also, these barns can be pretty industrial looking if you put the metal siding on them with a metal roof. They can be tall. They're allowed to be 32 feet tall. There's also been discussion about the environmental impact of if you put it in the wrong place. Discussion about wildlife corridors, discussion about wetlands, stream corridors, those kind of issues.
Okay, so let's look at these draft regulations. How will the county regulate size and height for minor accessory buildings and major accessory buildings?
So the way these are draft regulations, so these are just, you know, for discussion at this point. But the way it's written right now is it would divide the buildings into two categories, as you said, major and minor. the minor would be allowed to go up to 2,000 square feet, but it would be based on the square footage of the footprint of the home. So if you had a 2,000 square foot home, you could only have a 1,500 square foot minor accessory building. So it would be 75% of the footprint of the home. And then a major would be allowed to go up to 15,000 square feet as a conditional use. The one thing that we would do is you would not allow a major to be on a lot smaller than 1 acre in size.
So it's all kind of about getting things to look and feel a little more proportionate, I guess.
Right. Just the idea is to make the accessory building subordinate to the principal building. So subordinate, if your house is 5,000 square feet, subordinate would mean smaller. And so, you know, you'd want to have it smaller than that. And also the height would be lower than the, you know, homes are allowed to be 32 feet tall, but we would say for a minor, I think it was 20-foot height limit, and for a major, it was 26-foot height limit, so that the building was lower than the principal home on the lot.
Sure. So under these proposed changes, are there any limitations to the type of accessory structure someone can build? And I ask because I was reading through the staff report and I found some very specific examples of like a skating rink or a horse arena. Is this something that someone could put in their backyard?
Yeah, people are allowed to do that as an accessory building. We've had a number of cases where people put in, you know, skating rinks, basketball arenas, horse. The equestrian uses are very popular out in some of these areas. And so, yeah, people can do that.
Under these proposed changes as well?
Yeah, they'd still be able to do it. It just would limit the size.
Okay. So you could have a small skating rink in your backyard.
Yeah. Okay. You could just do faster laps, I guess.
Well, makes things easier, I guess. But there's also another category that pertains to this changes in the code, and that's steel containers. And maybe you can kind of describe what staff has come up with for those.
Yeah, the steel shipping containers, we've gotten a lot of complaints over the years about the steel shipping containers associated with the aesthetics. And so the proposal right now is to prohibit them in residential areas and only allow them in commercial areas. And in the commercial areas, they'd need to be screened and placed in the back of the lot. You know, and if it had the big sign from, you know, when it was out on the ocean still painted on it, they'd have to paint over that.
Right.
That one's going to be a good question for the Planning Commission because they're a simple and easy way to get storage on a lot. And so there might be, I'm assuming that there will be some people who will come forward and say, hey, we'd like to have these, but it'll be, it's a starting discussion for the Planning Commission.
Isn't that something that could just be replaced with like a shed or something similar?
Yeah.
Okay. So another concern that kind of stems from this whole conversation about accessory buildings is one about the buildings turning into a commercial operation, and that seems to be a recurring controversy in Silver mm-hmm. Creek. Do these changes address that at all?
Well, the commercial use has never been expressly allowed in these buildings. The concern is that the property owners will get their approval as a private use and then convert it illegally to a commercial use later. So the regulation stays the same as to prohibit the commercial use. It's just what this does is doesn't allow them to make it so large and so big, and hopefully it wouldn't have as many impacts, and so it would go back to enforcement eventually.
But is it difficult to enforce that?
It can be, because with our code enforcement, it's hard for us to, you know, be out and monitor a property 24/7. We do it off a complaint basis, and so if someone says they're running commercial business, we'll send our enforcement officer out to investigate, and then it's just a matter of figuring out if it's, you know, if it, sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not, and so we just have to investigate it.
Sure, and you can't be everywhere at once, so... well, not to minimize residents' concerns about the visual impacts of the accessory buildings, but isn't the classic way to address neighbors, you know, aesthetically displeasing backyards just to, you know, like plant some tall bushes or build a fence? Is this something that needs to be addressed through a code change?
That's a good point. I mean, we'll find out because there's a lot of people who buy these properties, these large lot properties, specifically to put one of these buildings back there or, you know, on their property. And if we restrict their ability to do that, that could be a problem. And so we'll find out from the public, you know, what they want when we start having the public hearings and, you know, getting input from the Planning Commission.
Ray, there's another item on the work session agenda that has your name on it, and it's another code change, but this time it kind of pertains to zoning. So can you tell us what the commission will be considering?
Yeah, so we're doing an update to the language for the residential zones, the RR, the MR, and the, HR zones. And so what we're doing is we're updating the use charts and updating some of the language as far as height is measured and setbacks and things like that.
Yeah, and it also looks like you're adding and deleting some different uses for those zones. Like, in particular, you're adding solar arrays, but you're deleting things like kennels and nurseries and vehicle control gates. So maybe you can kind of explain how staff came to those decisions.
Yeah, well, the way that those decisions have been made is we've been meeting with a subcommittee of our Planning Commission. We have three members of our Planning Commission who've graciously volunteered to be on a subcommittee, and we went through the uses with them. We had the discussions about, you know, what they would like to see, and those were uses that staff, along with the subcommittee, came up with as far as to add and to delete from the table.
Okay, Ray. Well, why don't you tell us how people can give comment on these different topics? When is the Planning Commission meeting for this work session?
So the work session will be tomorrow. The meeting begins at 4:30 in the Richens Building. The public is welcome. If they have comments, it is a work session for these two items. So the commission can take comments, but it's not scheduled for a public hearing. But we will be scheduling it up for a public hearing probably in September. And also they can contact the staff, planning staff, anytime. Give us comments, feedback. We'd love to have it. It's good to know what people want. So.
Okay. Ray Milliner from Summit County Planning, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Emily Means. It's just about 8:30. And in the studio with me, I have KPCW General Manager and President Renee Bodley Miller and Fundraising Manager Wendy Gorley, because this Friday, we're kicking it all off. We are 1 week away from launching the 2019 Summer Pledge Drive, and we've got a big party in the Big Alley Back Alley Bash this Friday. So, Renee, why don't you tell us what people can expect on Friday?
Well, it's going to be a great time. It's always a local's favorite. We try to do this the Friday before school goes back into session, and it's a great time for everyone to get together when they're back from summer vacation. School hasn't started yet. It's a great time to catch up with your neighbors and your friends. So it starts at 5 down at the Townlift Plaza, goes until 9, and it's free, Emily, which is always fun. So we're going to start with music from Joy and Eric, a local favorite. Then another local favorite takes over at 7, Sin City Soul. Here's what we got going on for the kids and the families: face painting, balloon twisting. I think Jennifer's got a bunch of lawn games mm-hmm. ready to go back there in the grassy area for the Town Lift Plaza. And we also have stickers, our new bumper sticker.
Those
kids
are great
love
stickers.
Those. Yeah, the dog. Everyone's
the
loving
every dog.
That. Everyone thinks it's their dog. And then we'll also have food for purchase and drinks for purchase. So let me thank our sponsors real quick. We do this in conjunction with Cole Sport. Gary and Jana Cole have been co-sponsors of this event for, I think, more than 30 years. They've been amazing. The Bridge Cafe, Town Lift Plaza, of course. Budweiser and Uinta Brewing will have some beverages there. Kumbaya Kitchens, Steve always does a great job putting food together. Devonza's, love their pizza. High West Distilleries and Butcher's Chop House. So you can go down there and get food, I think $10 a plate for
yes.
adults. Mm-hmm. And the drinks are $5 and $10. And it's an easy, inexpensive way to enjoy being in historic Old Town Park City.
Yeah, and kind of mingle with the rest of the community. And I'm really excited because this is my first Back Alley Bash.
Hooray, you're going to love it.
I think I will. Can you kind of tell us why this is something that KPCW does and why we kick off Pledge Drive this way?
Well, it's my first one as well.
How exciting.
Yes, I'm very excited. We'll have to hang out. I think that we always just felt like it was our way to give back appreciation for our the community. They support us so well all year long. And so I think that it's just a really fun way. And we also see it as a kickoff to our pledge drive right. on Monday, which is, for me, feels like also a community appreciation event. It's just the community coming together and not only appreciating us, but we have so many people in the studio, community leaders and organizations that are doing such important work in our area.
Well, it's a good time for KPCW to hear from the community. What's our fundraising goal this time for Pledge Drive?
$175,000. That's what we're trying to raise in just 4 days. So it will start Monday, August 19th. We'll end it at 6 p.m. on Thursday, the 22nd. And we used to do five-day pledge drives. And about 3 years ago, we shortened it to four. And we're trying really hard not to be so repetitive. People say, gosh, I hear give us money, give us money, give us money. And we have produced our pledge drives differently starting about 2 years ago, where we ask different nonprofits to come in and host an hour of the pledge drive. We got really positive feedback from the community from doing it this way.
Yeah, it's, you know, instead of a traditional pledge drive where we just do our regular programming and take commercial breaks where we hawk for money, we really have original programming where we're learning a lot about what's going on in our community. We have, that's one of the comments that I got off of last time was I learned so much, and I learned about nonprofits that I have never heard of before. And so I'm really excited about some of the ones that we have on the schedule that are new to us here on our pledge drive, especially we're trying to really extend out into the Heber Valley. And so we have the Wasatch County Arts Council and the Wasatch Education Foundation, which is akin to our Park City Education Foundation, doing that important work there in that area. And then Pause for Life is returning. And then we're having the Christian Center of Park City on, but we're really focusing also on the work that they're doing in Heber Valley. So those are some of the newer ones. But also we have Summit County Gardens, which I'm really excited about. Coley Ballou has been so enthusiastic about coming on the pledge drive. And then we have the Sundance Institute and Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, which I'm not sure we've had before. So you can see the vast variety of and sizes and in scope and purpose that we have on the air with us next week.
And these are all nonprofits. You know, part of KPCW's mission is to provide a voice for all area nonprofits. We let them have free PSAs. You know, when you're hearing our DJs play this great music and they take a break in the music and they talk about what's going on around town, they're talking about those fundraisers for those nonprofits and those events. We also offer discounted underwriting for nonprofits in town. So when you're hearing that spot for that nonprofit and their event, they're paying less than a for-profit organization. Not a lot of nonprofit public radio stations do it this way, Emily. You have experience with the public radio stations down in Salt Lake. You know, they're more of a traditional NPR format, and they're stuck in that NPR programming, which is excellent programming. Don't mean to denigrate that, but it doesn't give them a lot of time to share their airwaves with their local nonprofits. So when I go to conferences with other public radio stations from across the country, they're always interested in how we do this, because we tend to outpunch our weight as a small public radio station. And I tell them it's because we share the love of the airwaves. And in return, we get something back. So that's really nice for our community to support us the way they do.
We work really hard to make the pledge drive beneficial for everyone who comes in. We are certainly benefiting, but we also try to really benefit those nonprofits who are partnering with us next week. And one of the things that we do is we give away free underwriting for those, the four nonprofits who get the most calls during their hour and the four nonprofits who raise the most money. And, you know, we don't, you know, try to make this a cutthroat competition, but it's all in good fun. And those eight nonprofits really benefit and get a platform to continue their important messages on our airways.
The station gets something out of it. The nonprofits get something out of it. The donors also get something out of it. We have some great thank you gifts, too.
We sure do. We're very lucky. The business community in the Park City area and Heber Valley area have been very generous. They give us these thank you items. So if you call in and make a $50 pledge, you'll get a $25 gift certificate to a restaurant or a store. If you make a $200 pledge, you'll get a ski pass. So we're so thankful to the business community out there for donating those items and showing their support for public radio. And it's funny because a lot of people call in multiple times because they know they want that restaurant gift certificate or they want that dining and entertainment package. And we know it's a lot to ask someone to donate $500, but in return, they get that dining and entertainment package that's worth probably $300. And even somebody who calls in with a $25 pledge, Emily, they get a hat, you know, or a $10 gift certificate somewhere. So we try to give something back for everything that we get.
So $175,000, that's our goal, right?
That's our goal.
What does that fund here at the station?
Great question. So it's about 25 to 30% of our operating budget. That's both pledge drives put together, the winter pledge drive and the summer pledge drive. And for that, you get news. You get a five-person news department who is the only source of live local information. And, you know, unlike other media outlets that are for-profit media outlets, we don't have a paywall on our website. We don't even have a registration page on our website. We provide all of this news and information and content for free. You also get the Mountain Town sound. You get the music that we play every day. It costs money to buy that music. You get NPR programming, which, by the way, our NPR fees are going to go up 189%. That word just came down 2 weeks ago from the headquarters in Washington, D.C., and tomorrow I'm going to be on a day-long conference call about that. So our programming costs are going to go up from $29,000 a year to $60,000 a year. That's something that we had not anticipated. So things like that kind of get in the way when you're trying to operate a radio station every day, and we could not be here without the support of the community.
We'd also like to thank our sponsors during those hours with the nonprofits. Many of those hours also have a sponsor that they are just there to support that nonprofit and us as well. Our gold sponsor level sponsors are Vail, Epic Promise, Deer Valley, Promontory Foundation, Pendry Residences Park City, Sky Ridge Development, and Woodward Park City. And our silver sponsors are Summit Sotheby's International Realty, Iron Horse District, Mountain West Bank, Park City Angels, and then our bronze level sponsors are the Egyptian Theater, the Chicks Company, and Yo-Yo's Ying's Laundromat, which is just going through a name change to Lolo's Laundromat. It's a tongue twister, obviously, this morning for me.
So we need to head to our next guest, but I'm hoping that you'll each make your quickest and best pitch for why people should participate in the KPCW community in this way.
There are so many reasons, but the thing that hits me deepest in my heart is that local news is so important, more important than ever before.
An independent source of news and information is critical these days. Help support KPCW. Help support your favorite nonprofit. Go online, kpcw.org. Click on the Pledge Drive button and the online auction button. You'll see the schedule of nonprofits, who's coming in for what hours, what days. It's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks, everyone, for listening in.
And you can also find more information about Friday's Back Alley Bash and the Pledge Drive at kpcw.org. So, Renee and Wendy, thank you so much for joining
me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emily.
In Utah, one in three women experience some form of domestic abuse in their lifetime. To raise awareness in a lighthearted way, the Peace House is hosting its annual Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event on August 25th. And joining us with details are Peace House Prevention and Awareness Director Lisa Mackay and Prevention and Awareness Specialist Dwayne Domino. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming in. So I think this is the seventh year the Peace House has hosted this?
Yes, I believe so.
And if people have never participated before, what can they expect?
Well, last year was my first time participating. One thing they can expect is to have a lot of fun. We do wear our heels, so it's a men's march to support, to bring awareness to domestic violence. And last year when I participated, I wasn't expecting all the blisters I got, but so I did get some blisters.
Hey, it's hard to walk in those high heels.
Yes. And so, but we're going to have fun. So that's the one thing, was we do want to have a lot of fun around the issue, but it is a serious issue that we're wanting to bring awareness to. But it is a lot of fun. So
not to support the men who are walking, we have the Blister Sisters who support their favorite walker by carrying water, carrying signs, carrying Band-Aids. But also in advance of the event, we'll have an opportunity to paint posters for companies or organizations that will be marching together as groups. We really encourage that. They can make signs and carry them. We'll also have our first ever Walk a Mile in Her Shoes 2019 t-shirt. It's a really neat shirt. We'll have the Clothesline Project displayed.
That's a great project. I've seen that before at different universities.
Well, this project was created entirely by women and children and a few men in our area who have survived domestic violence and interpersonal violence. So that will be on display. We will also have some snacks. There'll be a photo opportunity there. We'll have some great music. We also have some great speakers to support us this year.
So it sounds like a whole day-long event, really.
Well, actually, we have a day-long worth of activities crammed into 2 hours.
So, like you said, this is a fun way to bring awareness to a serious issue. Why do you think it's effective, and maybe it's just more approachable to address serious issues in this way?
I think that people get fatigued with hearing sad and difficult news. There are, by keeping it lighthearted, we can engage a broader number of people. And I think that we're also able to reach a variety of ages, from children up to very mature adults. When you have a very serious message, which is appropriate at times as well, you sort of kind of start limiting your audience. We want to just alert our community to the presence of domestic violence in Wasatch and Summit counties. It's something that, by having this conversation, we open up avenues to prevention education so that we can ultimately reduce it.
So we often see instances of domestic violence in the news. And, you know, just recently we've had some higher profile domestic violence cases where the result has been, you know, young women being killed by their partners or former partners. Mm-hmm. At this event, what do participants learn about domestic violence?
Well, I'm going to talk for just a second about some of our speakers.
Sure.
Some of our speakers this year come from our Sheriff's Department in Summit and Wasatch counties. This is the most risky call for police officers to go out on, because domestic violence is very unpredictable. The issues of power and control can rapidly escalate. So one thing that our participants will learn about is that factor, that domestic violence is a very volatile situation, even more so than burglary or some other possible calls. Then the other thing, our other speaker is Casey Baird from KBAIR 101. He lost his daughter to a domestic violence relationship, and he'll be talking about the impact that's had on his life, on his family, the signs that he missed. So some of the things that he and his extended family missed, because domestic violence is a hidden issue. There's a lot of shame associated with it. So one of the things that they'll learn are some of the warning signs, some of the risks to our community at large, the scope of the impact. We all know somebody. 1 in 4 women in the course of their lifetime will experience this. 1 in 3 teens in their dating years will experience an unsafe relationship. So they'll get a sense also of, we all know somebody.
Let's take,
yeah, go ahead, Dwayne.
The one thing that's learned that's not said is actually wearing the shoes. When I was walking last year, it started out as being a fun thing, and it was. I did enjoy it. But as I'm walking up Main Street in these heels and my feet are starting to hurt, I did start noticing the women around me and the women in my lives. I married, have 3 daughters. And as my feet started to get a little sore, I started thinking about, what are they really experiencing? So these are the things that I was learning internally, and no one had to teach me in that moment, because I really was walking in a woman's shoes, and I thought about those things. So those things are starting to, the things that people will learn if they allow themselves to start really thinking about, what is it really like to walk in a woman's shoes?
Well, and I know we mentioned this in the context of women, because they are disproportionately affected by this,
right.
But men also experience domestic violence.
Correct.
So is this something that the men are thinking of as they're walking in their heels?
You know, when we get done, we do have a conversation afterwards, and this is a conversation that Lisa and I get to have year-round, and so we do address the things that are happening with men as well, and so the conversation just gets started, and I think with the conversation gets started, you can take that wherever it goes, and it's true, it does happen to men, but it does disproportionately happen with women. But if you can have that conversation and make it open, and it comes out of the shadows, and it's not a shameful thing for people who need help to get help, that's where you have to start. You have to have the conversation. So
I wanted to bring up one more thing before you all head out of here. And looking ahead just 1 month, the Peace House has a really exciting milestone coming up, which is the grand opening of your new campus. So can you give us any hints about the new facilities?
Well, our new facility has 8 crisis rooms with swing space. So this more than triples our current capacity. We have 12 transitional apartments, which is one of the barriers for women who experience violence and they have to rebuild their lives in our community. We have, we will eventually have a childcare. Expanded counseling and case management is already in place. So all of our services are growing and expanding, and we're adding some additional ones. The ribbon cutting is on the 21st from 9 to 11. We are really excited to welcome the community in. We haven't been able to do that in the past because our facility depended on the undisclosed location. So we'll be able to engage the community in-house in all kinds of new capacities.
That's really exciting. So, Dwayne, we're just running out of time, so I'll have you remind us once more about the details of Walk a Mile, and then also how can people contact the Peace House if they're seeking services or resources?
All right. So I'll talk about the Walk a Mile. So it is Sunday, August 25th. We'll be meeting at the Park City Bandstand at 11:30. That will be the check-in. They can go onto peacehouse.org if they want to register ahead of time. I also do have to mention our sponsors, because they've been good to us. We are sponsored this year by Crandall Capital, Utah Film Studios, Mary Jane's, which has been awesome, and DBR Joints, which does include No Name Saloon, Butchers, Boneyard, and the Wine and Dive. So we're excited to have them as a sponsors this year, and they've been helping us each year, actually.
They're very generous.
Yes.
If anyone needs support, they can always go to our website, peacehouse.org, and get connected there.
Okay. Well, Lisa Mackay and Dwayne Domino from the Peace House, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Students are heading back to school in the Park City School District in 1 week, and joining us in studio with a monthly update is Park City Education Foundation Executive Director Abby McNulty. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning.
So what are you looking forward to for this school year?
Well, I have 2 young kiddos myself, so always just the anticipation as a mom of sending your kids back to school after a nice, long, easy summer. But I think this is going to be a great school year. There's a wonderful administrative team in place, and the Education Foundation is investing about $1 million into teacher and classroom grants this year, as we do every year. And so that always helps significantly with the teacher and child's experience in the classroom.
So last fall, the Education Foundation conducted an in-depth survey of its audience, and the last time the organization did that was 10 years ago. So what kind of feedback were you looking for, and on what topics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we were doing strategic planning all last year, and a piece of that was surveying our audience to understand what we did well and what we don't do well. Lots of great feedback and good information for us to move forward. We've made some changes to the organization. We're not ready to roll them out just yet. But we did hear everyone's feedback, and we are going to move forward with some tweaks and changes. And we look forward to rolling that out over the next couple months.
So can you, it seems like you want to wait until you've got like the solid plan in place to announce what it is, but what was kind of the general sentiment from the community here?
Yeah, so general sentiment was people really loved the Ed Foundation and really love what we do, but couldn't necessarily say what we do. And so that's an opportunity for us to kind of talk more about why we exist and also target and focus our funds more specifically. So one thing just to mention today, we exist because Utah, unfortunately, is the lowest funded per pupil system in the country. And 96% of all tax dollars that are collected in Park City School District are redistributed throughout the state. And so money is an issue for our schools, and parents and teachers and students deserve the best that we can possibly afford. And so beyond your taxes, which do get redistributed, we ask people to make private contributions to the schools.
So you mentioned that you're working with about $1 million for this school year.
Yeah.
What does all that, well, first of all, where does all that money come from?
Right. All the money is raised through the community every year, each and every single year. And right now we have our back to school appeal. We ask parents to consider a donation of $180 a year per kid, and that's $1 a day for each day the kids are in the classroom. Our goal is always to have at least 50% of parents participating. Families who've come from school districts in California, for example, they're so familiar with this appeal because California has had a budget crisis in public education for many, many years. And that appeal is actually $1,000 per student, and they have about 90% participation.
So do we have 50% here?
We do. We do have 50%, yes.
Okay, all that money comes from the community, and then it goes towards programming for teachers and students.
Yeah, it gets redistributed through our grant programs. And so we have our teacher grants coming up this fall. And it funds programs that your kids probably really love. Makerspace, robotics, elementary visual arts, also known as EVA, coding. The list goes on. And it covers, our grants cover every student in the school district, pre-K to post-high school graduation.
So the teacher grants, is that where the majority of the funding goes towards? Or
Nope. So we have the different distribution buckets. Okay. And so essentially at the end of the day, it's about $1 million into the schools and impacting teachers and students.
What kind of programs, and I know you just mentioned a few, but since you still have teacher grants to award, what kind of programs most often or most successfully are awarded those grants?
What makes a compelling grant?
Yeah.
Is that? Well, I think all the things, outlining, what you need the funds for, and how it's going to impact students in the classroom. So we try and fund as much as we possibly can. We fund actually because of we're limited by how much money we raise each year. So we actually are only able to fund about 50% of the requests that come to us. So it is a hard decision. We have a committee of board members and community volunteers that make those decisions each year.
It sounds really competitive then. Can teachers reapply with the
yes.
same idea?
Sure. Teachers can reapply with the same idea. We also, our staff and our board is always happy to help answer questions, too, about what makes a good grant. And we provide examples, and we go to the faculty rooms, too, and sit and try and work with teachers, you know, through their ideas to help them write a strong grant that showcases their idea as best as possible.
So you mentioned there's a request for fundraising, you know, as we head into the school year. You also have a few different fundraising opportunities, the Beat the Call push that I've heard about.
Yes. So that's part of our parent appeal, which is $180. So we ask parents right now, as you're going to register, I know my son is registering at Ecker Hill next week. There's an opportunity to give it registration. If you miss that opportunity, then there's also a chance to give what's called during Beat the Call. And so you can make your contribution. It's over a 2-week period, and flyers will come home with your students, or you can go online during Beat the Call. And then if by any chance you haven't given, we have a group of students that we work with that will then reach out with phone calls to say, hey, you know, you might have missed us the first couple of times, but we're still looking to raise money to support our teacher and classroom grants.
So 50% participation here. What would you say to people, to parents who've never donated before, to kind of encourage them to do that?
That's a great question. I would just remind them that Utah, unfortunately, is the lowest funded education system in the country, and that 96% of the tax dollars locally collected for schools is redistributed throughout the state. So there is a significant need in our community to provide additional funds to our teachers and students to support a really high quality, enriching classroom experience.
Abby, we're going to have to end it there. Happy school year.
Yeah.
I'm sure your kids are really excited to go back, are they?
It's a hard transition. Summer's so fun, but it's great once it starts.
You're right. So Abby McNulty from the Park City Education Foundation, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.